This week on Tell Somebody, the last of a three-part series of conversations with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. This is Tom Clamer. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Hello and welcome to the podcast of Tell Somebody for July 24th, 2014. This show is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the show broadcast weekly on 90.1 FM KKFI Community Radio in Kansas City. More information at www.tellsomebody.us. Follow us on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now, or look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook. This is your host, Tom Clamer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. The podcast of last week's show with Ray McGovern has been posted. On that show, Ray talked about the current mess in Iraq, the lies and blunders of U.S. policymakers that brought it to that point, and a little bit about the human reality of the havoc wreaked there by the United States. Look for links to this podcast at tellsomebody.us and links to some of the photos that Ray talked about. On with the show. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern returns to give some of his unique perspectives on illegal spying by the NSA. Does that stand for No Such Amendment? The complicity of the major media in that illegal spying, and some of the history of the FISA court process which arose from Church Committee hearings of the 1970s. Ray McGovern is a former Army intelligence officer who served 27 years as a CIA analyst. His duties included preparing the president's daily intelligence brief. Ray is a founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and works with Tell the Word, an expression of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city, Washington, D.C. I recorded this conversation with Ray McGovern on July 10, 2014. Give a listen. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thank you, Tom.
Ray, as we're recording this on the 10th of July, we've just gotten word about five prominent Muslim Americans who've been apparently illegally surveilled and had their email read and so forth by the NSA. How did we get to this point where we have this sort of thing going on and apparently very widespread? There's just revelation after revelation coming out of documents Snowden released.
Well, Tom, it really is quite amazing. The story that broke today, that is the 10th of July, really, really quite remarkable. There are a bunch of people that were surveilled, and Glenn Greenwald and some of his assistants weeded out the list and found 10 or so, and then five were willing to have their cases publicly aired. And so a couple of those were cited on Amy Goodman this morning, and the whole business is that their only sin was being American Muslims. They're all U.S. citizens, and not only are they Muslims, but they're politically active, okay? In other words, they use their First Amendment rights under the Constitution and speak out. So this is quite remarkable. One of the spreadsheets, instead of John Doe, had a fake name, you know, a placeholder name, Muhammad Raghead.
Charming.
Yeah.
Pretty, you know, classy.
That's as bad as it gets, you know. Might as well put, what they call the VC,
Gooks.
Kinds of pejorative names that you want to marginalize or dehumanize people. So this is a Mohammed rag head. It's right there. You can see it right up there in the sheet. One of the things that Glenn Greenwald has, one of the points he's made is that the Fourth Amendment really is out the window. I often, in interviews, I say to an interviewer when we have less time, in a kind of hurried way, I'd say, now, the Fourth Amendment is only one sentence. It's okay if I read it? And then before he or she can say, well, then I read it. That's what I'm going to do now. Is that all right?
You got time here.
Yeah. Okay. It's real simple, and it really is only one sentence. And it comes out of the experience that our founders had with the British. The British could come into our homes, rifle through our papers, take off our wives or daughters, do anything they wanted without any warrants. What they had was what they call a general warrant from the king, I suppose, where any house, any papers, anything they could snoop at or snatch, they could. So the people who framed the Bill of Rights were frightfully aware of that, and they knew that they wanted to prevent that in the future. And so the Fourth Amendment reads as follows. The right of the people to be secure. See, it all has to be secure. It has to do with security, Tom. You know, different kind of security, but the kind of security that's necessary for freedom. Okay, I'll just quote again. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Period, end quote. Now, I'm no lawyer, but probable cause sticks out there like a sore thumb for me. In other words, you're not allowed to do any of these things. People are to be protected against unreasonable searches and seizures unless there's probable cause to consider them terrorists or some other kind of... Now, the kind of blanket surveillance that NSA has instituted to all of us, and the very intrusive inspection and surveillance they've done against these Muslim folks is not based in any way on a probable cause. All of these people have unblemished records. One of them worked in the Department of Homeland Security with the highest clearances. Another one is the director of CARE, the most prominent Muslim civil rights organization. Now, these guys were beyond, beyond any shadow of a doubt, good citizens, and yet somebody in their suspicious mind said, well, you know, let's monitor their emails and all that kind of stuff. And Ed Snowden, to his credit, saw that as a crude violation of the Fourth Amendment, and he brought out the evidence with him. So the Fourth Amendment has been trashed, and... You know, it's a very curious sort of thing, Tom, because people say, well, you know, even if there's only an outside chance that one of us is involved in terrorism, I don't mind. I got nothing to hide. I let them there. Well, you know, it's a really, really dicey attitude. You don't get to decide what the government knows about you. The government gets to decide. And you may think your activities are completely innocent, but the government may think that they're subversive. And as I think you know, Tom, the government can just wrap you up and hold you indefinitely on the slightest suspicion that you're a terrorist or that you're some kind of a reprobate or a dissident. That's the National Defense Authorization Act that was passed 2 years ago. So this is very serious stuff. And, when people say, well, I have nothing to hide, someone posed this right after Ed Snowden started revealing what he brought out with him to Hong Kong. Someone got a hold of Helmut, but Wolfgang Schmidt. Now, that's his real name. He was a fairly senior Stasi official in East Germany. Now, Stasi, for those who haven't seen Das Land, how's it go? Das Leben der Anderen, the lives of others. It was up for a Academy Award. It did win some kind of awards. It's an incredibly vivid illustration of what it was like for the East Germans to live under the Stasi, which is their sort of combined CIA-FBI. And one of the big things was the Abhören, the eavesdropping on just about everybody and anything. And so here, Wolfgang Schmidt is asked right after Snowden comes out, well, what do you say? What do you say to people who say they have nothing to hide? This is golden, Tom. He says this, it's translated into English. He says, it is incredibly naive to think that you have nothing to hide and that the government will not use this information against you. This is why the government collects this information, and the only way to prevent it from being used against you is to prevent it from being collected in the first place. End quote. Right? Now that's it. The only way to skin this cat, I gotta be crude with the analogy, is to stop the collection in the first place. And all this legislation that held such promise for us about 3 months ago, it's all been whittled down. And I haven't read the last chapter and verse, but it looks to me as though this is not happening. The collection will continue, and indeed bulk collection will continue, and indeed probable cause has been thrown out the window.
Yeah, and let's talk about that probable cause just a little bit and remind any listeners here that missed it on this show in the past and speaking in Kansas City and elsewhere. You have brought up how somebody in a position where it's important to know these things claimed that there was no such clause in the Fourth Amendment. And I'm spacing out the TV reporter who highlighted this a few years ago, but the rest of the mainstream media pretty much ignored it then and ever since. When somebody who is in charge of so much of this in different positions and is subject to Senate confirmation says that there's no probable cause in the Fourth Amendment, one can imagine in a better world than what we live in that journalists and media would make a big deal out of this. Can you just talk about that a bit?
Yeah, well, this is sort of a really symptomatic symbol, really. This was not in some, Georgetown bar. This was at the National Press Club. Major presentation by one General Michael Hayden, who had been head of NSA and then was promoted to become deputy to the Director of National Intelligence, a step up, and then later was nominated to become head of the CIA for services performed. Well, one of those services happened after James Risen carried that story that the New York Times finally published, which revealed this bulk eavesdropping in contravention of the Fourth Amendment. And that happened on December 2006. I'm sorry. We're getting here now. 2005. So the following January, 2006, Hayden, all spit and polished with his Air Force uniform there with four stars, is helping Alberto Gonzalez, the forlorn attorney general, explain everything to the people, explain it all, okay? And they're the National Press Club. So Jonathan Landay, who some of your listeners may remember as the gutsy reporter from McClatchy, who wouldn't buy the propaganda about weapons of mass destruction before Iraq, and he and his colleagues were virtually the only ones in the media that got it right. Anyhow, he stands up and he says, "No, General Hayden, how do you explain collecting this kind of information in violation of the Fourth Amendment?" And Hayden says, "Well, we just had reasonable suspicion that some of these people might have been deserted." And Landay interrupts and says, no, my understanding, General, is that in the Fourth Amendment, it requires probable cause. And he says, no, that's not just reasonable suspicion. And they said, it says that in the Fourth Amendment, probable cause. And he said, no, it doesn't. It comes from Obelman, actually. Obelman put it on the TV that night. And the rest of it that just has Hayden declaring how scrupulously attentive they all are at NSA to the Fourth Amendment. And Obelman comments at the end, well, maybe they have a different copy of the Constitution out there at NSA. Now, one of the points here, one of the teaching points, seems to me, that, let me put it this way. I was speaking to a group of journalists 2 weeks ago, and I said, were any of you there at the National Press Club when Hayden said that? And none of them were there. And I said, well, do you suppose any journalist might have been there? I mean, after all, it's the National Press Club. And the only people who picked it up was Keith Olbermann. He had it on that night. Everybody else ignored it. I talked to Jonathan Landy about 2 months ago. I said, no, it just was not worthy of news that the Deputy Director of National Intelligence had asserted that probable cause was not in the Fourth Amendment. So there's a problem. We have no Fourth Estate. That's the bad news. The press, the media in this country is co-opted. The good news, of course, is that with community radio like yours, the internet and the web, well, that's really the fifth estate, as I call it. And there's great hope there. And it's catching on. It's catching on. So, you know, it's kind of, it's really an amazing story because, you know, I was there for all of it, really. I was with the CIA for 27 years, and I remember very vividly. And do you think that your listeners might care to hear about how the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was composed and enacted, and why, and what happened back there when J. Edgar Hoover was bugging each and every telephone he could find? Would that be of interest, or do you think that's a little hat for most people?
I would be very eager to hear that right now, and I suspect many other listeners would as well, so please.
Okay. Well, as you know, J. Edgar Hoover was snooping on just about anyone he thought he might like to snoop on, and those included, of course, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and it's an interesting story, you know. To snoop on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he would have needed the approval of the Attorney General. The Attorney General, during that period of time, was a fellow named Bobby Kennedy.
Right.
Yeah, a real, real liberal, right? A person who wouldn't stand for that kind of thing. Well, guess what? I mean, he stood for it. And, you know, I asked Colleen Rowley, who I know you've had on your show, I asked her, Colleen, how do you figure that? You know, how do you figure that? And she said, Ray, come on. You're supposed to be a crackerjack analyst. J. Edgar Hoover had the book on everybody. He knew about the Kennedy brothers. He knew the follies that went on in the White House pool and elsewhere. He knew about these young ladies that they took a shine to and vice versa. And so when he went to Bobby Kennedy, he said, I was going to do this. I mean, Ray, I know you don't like to use foul language, but blackmail is what we're talking about here. Blackmail, you got it?
I think it was somebody in the Nixon administration that coined the phrase, if you got them by the balls, the hearts and minds will follow. And Bobby Kennedy's heart and mind followed.
Yeah, so it was that bad. Anyhow, that's sort of just symptomatic of what it was like then. Everybody was afraid of J. Edgar Hoover, including presidents, okay? Now, when it really hit the fan, and people went after these students demonstrating against Vietnam, and they saw that this was an organized kind of cabal, and that people like the defense intelligence people and the CIA, whose charter did not extend to policing in this country, were involved in all this stuff, and the FBI was going amok, and the CIA as well. Well, Senator Frank Church decided that he would convene a committee, and there was a parallel committee in the House, and was called the Church Committee eventually. And what they did was look into all the revelations sparked first and foremost by Seymour Hersh about this, what they call the family jewels of CIA, which included, you know, hallucinogenic drugs and assassinations and all kinds of stuff that nobody wanted to hear about but needed to be flushed out. So very, very courageously, Frank Church convened this committee and in very short order found out that he was on a list, his conversations were being overheard, his phone was bugged. You know, he was wired by J. Edgar Hoover himself, so that's how bad it was. He conducted these investigations and thoroughly embarrassed the evildoers, as George W. Bush would put it, the people who broke the law flagrantly. And one of the upshots of that, having to do with intercepting communications, was something called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. You hear it referred to as the FISA Act of 1978. Okay. Now, Bobby Ray Inman, an admiral, was head of NSA at the time, and he helped draft that thing. And the upshot of it was that the Fourth Amendment was reinstated. I'm not going to read it to you again, but I will read you what became the First Amendment out at the National Security Agency. And that First Amendment reads, "Thou shalt not eavesdrop on Americans without a court warrant," period. Real simple. Now, I'll tell you, I was working in the CIA at the time as an analyst, and so I was in receipt of all manner of intercepted communications from NSA, and all of a sudden, it started to look a little bit like those paper dolls that they cut out. You know, there were holes. There were holes in these sheets of paper that came off the ticker. And I couldn't believe it. I said, what's going on here? Well, they were razored out names of American citizens. Now, in other words, it didn't suffice to blacken them out, because I guess you could apply some sort of chemical and bring back the letters. They razored them out. Now, that's how seriously Bobby Ray Inman and his immediate successors took their injunction against eavesdropping on Americans without a court warrant. Anytime an American name appeared in an intercepted message, that thing was razored out. Can you imagine how labor intensive that was?
Yeah.
It was done. So, that there it stood in 1978, and there were certain, there were sporadic violations of that, but very few, and nobody sort of thumb their nose at the FISA Act, indiscriminately, until George Bush and Dick Cheney came into office. Now, one of the things that they did very soon, like the first or second week of their tenure, was they called Michael Hayden, three-star general at the time, Air Force. He was head of NSA, and they said, "Now, General Hayden, we know, we've heard about that First Amendment out there, NSA, thou shalt not eavesdrop on Americans without a court warrant, and we're here to tell you, forget about it. Forget about it. I want you to go out there to San Francisco, get a way to plug into all AT&T and Verizon take. We want a back door, that's what we call it, and we want to be able to have all that stuff." So, as I say, Tom, this was just a couple of weeks after they came into office, before, I emphasize, before 9/11. Gross disregard for the Fourth Amendment and the First Commandment out there at NSA. Now, after 9/11, this thing went on steroids, really on steroids. And Hayden just cooperated completely in introducing these blanket surveillance programs. They didn't even have a name for it initially, but then when they were caught, they decided to call it the Terrorist Surveillance Program. Can you imagine? You know, terrorist is always good to have in the title.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what happened next is really interesting. James Risen, for whom I have great respect, he's the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter specializing in national security matters. He had some sources that told him that NSA was violating the First Amendment of NSA, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. Willy-nilly, they had these blanket programs, and they had introduced them, and they were on steroids after 9/11. Now, that's a big story, and Risen had it. And it was summer of 2004. So he went to his superiors there at the New York Times, Sulzberger and the rest. He said, oh, this is dynamite. It shows that Cheney and Bush are willy-nilly violating the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. We need to get the story out. Well, in my day, Todd, the New York Times would do their due diligence and check on their sources and everything and then publish. But these days, and back then, we're talking the summer of 2004, the Times had fallen into the habit of asking for permission from the White House. And that's what they did. They went to the White House and said, you know, we've got these reports. They seem plausible. Okay if we publish them? And Bush and Cheney said, 9/11, 9/11, fear, fear, terrorist, 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 national security, 9/11, national security, terrorist, fear. No, you can't do that. And so Sulzberger said, oh, okay, all right. Now, they didn't do it. And we're talking in 4 or 5 months before the 2004 election. Just think, Tom. Do you think that if the Times did its job in publishing all the news that's fit to print, and certainly this was fit to print by their star journalist, do you think that the outcome of that election, there might have been a little different?
Amen.
Times knows what's best for the American people, knows what's best for its entree to the White House, and the New York Times didn't do anything. Now, 15, 16 months pass. Okay, James Risen has this story in a book that he's written, which has other very, very intriguing inside stories. And Svengali, it's December 2005 now, right? So 15 months after Risen first learned it. And he goes to Sulzberger and he says, now, sir, with all due respect, I'm really glad, happy that you're still paying me these big figure salaries, but, and so I don't want you to be embarrassed, but you should know, sir, that my book is coming out 2 weeks from now, it's in Galley, and I just, you know, wonder if you've thought about what people will think when a Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times writer puts a book out and, the Times doesn't run the story. So Sulzberger said, oh, you're right about that. Oh, yeah. So what do you think Sulzberger did? Give me a guess, Tom.
I think he maybe ran the story finally.
Well, you're almost right. First thing he did was to call up the White House.
Oh, okay, sure.
To ask for permission.
Mother, may I?
Yeah, and... George Bush said, no, why don't you come down here and we talk it out. So, next thing you know, Sulzberger and the New York Times bureau chief in Washington are called into the Oval Office. And what does Bush say? Terrorism, terrorism, fear, fear, national security. 9/11, 9/11, you forget about terrorism, you can't do it. That would be, you know, it would be terrible for national security. And Sulzberger says, we put the story off since the summer of last year, and I'm sorry, I just have to do it. and push Slaughter in the Senate. National security should come first. So some government walks out the door, and the White House knows that the cat's out of the bag. It's going to be published when, who knows, next week or so. And that's the 5th of December, 2005. Now, on the 6th of December, this is kind of interesting if you look at the chronology. Rush Holtz, a congressman from New Jersey, who actually served in State Department intelligence. He's a scientist, really good guy, and served on the House Intelligence Committee. So his portfolio included NSA. And he had long since scheduled a parish call out there at NSA to kind of touch base with General Alexander, who had succeeded General Hayden. And so he went out to NSA on the 6th of December, and he said to General Alexander, "General Alexander, you know, there are a lot of rumors going around this town that you're snooping on American citizens. Now, are you doing that?" And Alexander said, "How could you even ask me that question? Of course we're not. Yeah, but that's against the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment out here at Fort Meade and National Security and Police beyond there." Well, poor General Alexander. Nobody in the White House that was privy to the conversation with Sulzberger thought to forewarn him that the cat was out of the bag. So what happens next? The 18th of December 2005, New York Times runs the story. Rush Holt, the congressman, is incredibly angry. He goes to his name was Hoekstra, Peter Hoekstra, the head of the committee, Republican from Midwest, some Michigan, I think. He goes to him, he says, "Hey, this is terrible. They lied to me. That's a double sin. You're not supposed to lie. You're not supposed to lie to a congressman or senator doing his official duties." And Hoekstra says, "Big deal. That's not a big deal. Just, you know, forget about it." So Holt famously says, "I'm not going to forget about it. If I have anything to do with this guy, he'll never get a fourth star." Okay? We're talking General Alexander. Well, there was a big cleanup act here, you know, sort of like after the elephants leave the circus, and poor, what's his name, Gonzalez, the attorney general, and Michael Hayden are designated as the cleanup crew. So they appear on the 21st of December at this big press conference, and they try to talk about, you know, how it's really okay. They hadn't violated anything. And then the next thing you get is the speech that we alluded to at the beginning, where General Hayden says, the Fourth Amendment doesn't say probable cause. Okay. Now, General Hayden did such a great job that when Porter Goss, a former congressman, really blew it when he became head of the CIA after George Tenet, when they wanted to get rid of him, they needed somebody to put in his place. Hayden had proved his mettle, had shown his stripes. You know, he's willing to explain anything, right? And he's willing to read the Fourth Amendment in a different way. I mean, he's just the guy for the CIA. Now, this part of the story is also interesting because I had a front seat for this by happenstance. Next thing you know, on the 8th of May, 2006 now, General Michael Hayden is nominated to take the place of Porter Goss, who sort of flunked out as CIA director. Now, what happens next? Well, by coincidence, that same day, there was a big meeting at the New York Public Library, and James Rising was there, and so was Bobby Ray Inman, whom I alluded to before as one of the very early directors of NSA, a Navy admiral, with wide respect on both sides of the aisle and among just about everybody in Washington. He was regarded as the consummate professional intelligence officer, okay? So he's there, and Rising's there, and the subject, of course, is what Hayden had done at NSA. And Admiral Bobby Ray Inman says, "Well, what he did was clearly illegal. I mean, I know that. I was there when the FISA law was being written. I even put in a sentence there that says you can't do anything that is not expressly permitted in this FISA act." So, yeah, he clearly broke the law. Now, this is, you know, virtually across the street from the New York Times. But guess what? The New York Times missed that. Matter of fact, all the media missed that. And if it weren't for Steve Clements, a terrific guy, a real Washington insider who, by some stratagem, got an invitation to the New York Public Library that night, he put it on his blog. And I'm reading his blog, and I say, wow, great, somebody, Bobby Ray Inman, is indeed, the superlative professional. He's willing to call a spade. It is illegal. He's saying General Hayden did it illegally. Now, what happens? Now, that's on the 8th of May. On the 17th of May, I am invited to be on Lou Dobbs. Why? Well, because I had a debate with Donald Rumsfeld the week before, and Dobbs wanted me to come up to New York and talk about that. So here I'm sitting in Lou Dobbs' sitting room, and I had watched Amy Goodman that morning, and guess what Amy did? She showed video of Admiral Inman saying General Hayden clearly broke the law. He did things that were expressly forbidden by the FISA Act.
Oh, wow. I knew the reporter witnessed it and wrote it down. I didn't even realize we had a video of it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how Amy got it, but she did. Now, we're talking the 17th of May, right?
Yeah.
I'm sitting in Lou Dobbs' green room, and all of a sudden comes in this little guy with no tie or jacket on. He's bespectacled, and he's a little old, you know, and it's Bobby Ray Inman. And so I say, Admiral Inman, great to see you. Oh, great job at the New York Public Library. And I knew, because I had been told, that he was going to take a couple of my minutes to explain what he thought of General Alexander as the nominee to be head of the CIA. And so as he goes into the room, taking part of my time, I said, you know, tell him like it is, Bobby Ray, tell him like it is. So he goes in, and I'm sitting in my chair in the room there, and of course the big tube is on there, and I'm watching it. Lou Dobbs says, well now, Admiral Inman, tell us about General Hayden. Do you think he's a good candidate to be head of the CIA? And Inman says, couldn't have picked a better guy. He's incredibly full of integrity. His acumen in technical matters is non-paralleled. He's certainly the terrific guy for the job.
Oh, boy.
Look at David. I'm about to throw something at the monitor, you see. And we took just a couple of minutes, and then Inman comes out. I looked at him and say, so you changed your mind. I know what you said at the library. He said, oh, so he gave the girl the tie that she let him borrow, and he's out. And I would have followed him had it not been that, you know, I was next, and he had already used up some of my time with Lou Dobbs. Now, what's the lesson there? Well, you know, it's a really sorrowful lesson. These guys, these four-star admirals or generals, they took the same oath I did to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Up until that time, I had thought that Bobby Ray Inman had done it for his whole career, because I saw him do it. But you know what? Once you're part of the club, and once one of your colleague four stars gets in a little hot water, and once Amy Goodman, God bless her, puts it around on the tube, and it could be very dangerous at the confirmation hearings for General Hayden, then the mafia, then the brotherhood of four-star generals sticks together, and Bobby Ray Inman goes in and lies through his teeth to Lou Dobbs so that no senator can say, hey, I'm aware of what you said at New York Public Library. How do you explain that? Because if they dare say that, then Bobby Ray Inman, well, I was misquoted. Look what I told to Lou Dobbs. So that was a very sorrowful thing, and, you know, it's sort of a clausura here, a little footnote. It was about 10 days later that the confirmation hearings were held for General Hayden to become head of the CIA. And it was really interesting because here's Hayden. He's bragged a couple of times, I know, because it stuck in my stomach, So, you know, I'm a product of 14 years. No, I used to say 15. 15 years of Catholic education. And I did the math, and, you know, I only had 14 years. So I guess in the 15th year, you learn how to lie to lie through your teeth and, you know, break your solemn oaths to protect the Constitution. So, you know, I'm glad I missed that 15th year of Catholic education, because that's what he must have learned there that I didn't learn. In any case, it was a whiff of conscience that showed through in the confirmation hearings, and I was watching it live, you know. And here's what happened. Senator Kit Bond, Republican from Missouri, he was vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Overlook Committee. They used to call it Oversight Committee, but in recent decades, these are Overlook Committees, not right. Oversight Committees.
Absolutely.
So it was a canned question, okay? And this was Kit Bond's question. He said, quote, "General Hayden, I do believe that your primary responsibility as director of the NSA was to execute a program that your NSA lawyers, the Justice Department lawyers, and White House officials all told you was legal, and that you were ordered to carry it out by the President of the United States," end quote.
Wow.
Now, Hayden blew it. I guess maybe he did have a little whiff of conscience there. Instead of the simple, yes, of course, I would follow order of the President of the United States. That's my primary responsibility. That was the script. But instead of that, Hayden pauses, like for, it seemed like 5 minutes, but probably about half a minute. And then he spoke rather poignantly in a low voice, and he said, quote, "I had to make this personal decision in early October 2001. And it was a personal decision, and I decided I could not do this," end quote. So I'm looking at that, I'm saying, oh, it just gave away. I mean, why should it be such a tough personal decision to obey an order of the United States, President of the United States? So, you know, well, it was an unconstitutional order. It was against everything that he swore an oath to uphold and support. And so that's why it was so hard. And he didn't pass the smell test. And I could see it, but he was whisked in with a big majority of folks. Nobody raised what Amy Goodman or Steve Clemens had revealed. And it came out in the hearings that not only did Hayden not seek a written opinion from his own general counsel out there at NSA, you know, you would think that when the director of NSA is told to do something so illegal, so unconstitutional, you go out and you check with your general counsel. You say, well, you know, can you write up an opinion here? I want to do it. You told me to do it. It seems like I want, you know, but you know, fix it up like lawyers do. Well, he didn't even trust this guy, Deitz, or was the guy's name, General Counsel, Robert L. Deitz. He didn't even trust him to set something down in writing. And so he got a, quote, oral opinion, end quote, to do this unconstitutional work. And, you know, what happens since then, we're talking mid-2006, they've modified the FISA law in 2008 to allow these judges, the FISA court judges, they call them, to do various and sundry to, against the Constitution, go ahead and approve blanket surveillance, irrespective of probable cause. And what Glenn Greenwald revealed just recently is really quite shocking. You know, they say, well, there's, you know, checks and balances here. The FISA law makes it necessary for these FISA judges to rule as to whether a warrant can be issued and what kind of warrant. Well, number one, I read the Fourth Amendment to you. It expressly prohibits general warrants of the kind the British had against us back then. It had to particularly define the place to be searched or the person or thing to be seized. there had to be probable cause and all that. Well, what happened here is that we have statistics now about how many of these warrant applications, and as I say, some of them are general warrants now, the FISA courts have approved.
Something like 99%, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Max, you're understating it, Thomas. 99.9%.
Wow.
The hard figures are 35,000 approvals, 12 disapprovals. Pretty good record, huh?
Yeah.
I'd
like to see the stats on prosecutors across the country in criminal cases and, you know, what's their track record? I suspect it's a little lower.
Yeah, well, that was brought out, you know. You go into any county in this country, and even if it's a breaking and entering sort of charge or, you know, whatever, you won't find 99.9% of the requested warrants ordered or approved. So the whole system is complicit. And I say that with great sorrow. You know, we all learned in civics, or all learned in early government courses, that there was a balance of powers between the executive, the Congress, and the judiciary. Now we have the executive running amok, approving all this stuff, the president himself lying about these things, and we have the Congress not oversighting, but overlooking. Dianne Feinstein saying, I will never, never vote to curtail these NSA programs. And then you have these FISA judges, these faux judges, I call them, quasi judges, who are appointed by the Supreme Court Chief Justice, and who labor in secret. There's nobody representing anybody else, just the government. I mean, this is not something that our founders envisaged, and yet, so the bottom line here for me is all three branches of our government are complicit in these gross violations of the Constitution. The hope is that as these things become exposed, thank goodness for Edward Snowden, that enough Americans will wake up so that you know, somebody equivalent to Frank Church can come forward and say, look, you know, this is not who we are. This is not the America that we inherited and that need to pass on to our children. And get serious about changing people and changing the law back to what it was, back to what the Constitution provides. But until people get sufficiently troubled by what's going on, and to the degree they don't get angry, let me just kind of finish up here. As you know, I was trained by Jesuits, right? And we had to study a lot of Thomas Aquinas. Matter of fact, some of the smart people in other Catholic colleges in New York used to call us peeping Thomists, okay? Anyhow, I sometimes you remember something from college. And when I was getting so angry with the invasion of Iraq, clearly a war of aggression, and the anger wouldn't go away, and I was thinking, wow, this is bad, because up in the Bronx where I grew up, you weren't allowed to be angry. Weren't supposed to be angry for more than a day, or if you were Irish, you know, maybe give you 2 days, maybe a week. But I was angry all the time. And then I remembered what Aquinas had said about the virtue of anger. You got that? Virtue. See, he wrote a lot about virtue, and he wasn't really good about other stuff, but he's pretty good on these Aristotelian and philosophical concepts. And what he tried to do is describe various virtues, and he took justice, for example, where he took various examples of virtues, and when he came to anger, the virtue of anger, he got really upset because there was no word in Latin, the language that he wrote in, no word for the virtue of anger. In other words, just enough anger, not too much. There was a Latin word for that. Iracundia was that word. Not too little, but milk toasty type thing, but just enough anger. And so, he compared it to courage, for example. courage in media res. Virtue is in the middle, right? Foolhardiness, no good. Timidity, no good. So virtue's in the middle. The virtue of courage is just enough courage. Okay, so he had nothing to rely on, so he goes back to the 4th century church, John Chrysostom, who said, and he quotes, "He or she who is not angry when there is just cause for anger sins." Why? He says, because anger respicit bonum justitiae. Anger looks to the good of justice. And if you can live amid injustice without anger, you are unjust. And then, as Aquinas normally does, he had his own little corollary. He came out strongly against what he called unreasoned patience. Okay, that's the best translation we could do from the Latin. He said, unreasoned patience sows the seeds of vice, nourishes negligence, and encourages not only evil people, but good people to do evil, end quote. Well, you know, there's far too much unreasoned patience going on here in this country, just as there was in Germany of the 30s. People know better, but they think, well, I'm pretty safe. I got nothing to hide. And this got to stop, Tom. If it takes us getting out in the street and demonstrating and making sure that our congressmen and representatives and senators know about how strongly we feel about the Bill of Rights, then that's what we got to do, because that's what the Germans didn't do. And look what happened from 1933 to 1945.
Ray, we have just about wound the clock down. I wonder if in the minute or two we have left, you could say a few words about this oath you took to the Constitution. And in part, I bring that up because I'm still hearing stuff about Snowden. He had an oath or a promise not to reveal secrets, but nobody talks about the oath to the Constitution in his context or in terms of the Haydens and some of these other clowns.
Yeah. Well, Hayden and the rest of them demonstrably broke their oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's the way it reads. That's the oath I took as a young Army officer. And that is the oath that Ed Snowden took when he joined the Army for that brief period of time, again when he joined the CIA, and probably again when he worked for NSA. Okay? Now, oaths are very different from promises. What the secrecy agreement amounts to is a promise. It's sort of like a contract. And the contract reads secret, confidential, and top secret information could damage the national security, and the signer here agrees not to release any classified mission and any classified information because of the damage to national security. Okay, now, are promises important? Of course they are. You don't break promises willy-nilly. But how do you compare, in a moral kind of plane, that kind of contract not to divulge national security information because it could damage the national security? We're not talking about preventing embarrassment to a government. We're talking about national security. How do you compare that with your solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic? Well, Ed Snowden has talked eloquently about this. He doesn't say this, but the theologians and philosophers have this notion of a supervening value, okay? Now, that means that some oaths and some promises are important, but some oaths would supersede promises of the kind I mentioned. So without having the Thomistic or the philosophical psychologist and so forth that I had at Fordham, Ed's twice as smart as I am, and he knew instinctively that his oath to the Constitution was more important than this promise not to endanger national security. What he's done here is not endanger national security. He's added to the security. Remember that first part of the Fourth Amendment?
Yeah.
The right of persons to be secure in their houses and so forth. So one thing that not many people know, Tom, is that one of his co-workers in Honolulu, he or she, let's say it was a she, she got really upset about all this character assassination, and so she went to Forbes, I think it was, a business magazine. And she said, you know, I don't know what to think about what Ed did. But I will tell you that he had a copy of the Constitution on his desk. Every now and then he'd whip it out and he'd say, hey, is what we're doing consonant with the Fourth Amendment? I mean, do you think it is? And we used to say, Ed, forget about it. Don't you like to think for yourself, Egan? Don't you like to live here? And I went, forget about it, Ed. And that was really interesting about it, because he wouldn't forget about it. He kept raising it with us. Now, she ends up saying, I don't know whether what he did was right or wrong, but I know it was very much in character for him to have done that, and I really resent the character assassination, because this was one man of integrity. Her words. Now, did you know that? No. It's buried in this forced little article, and that's part of the problem. I think Americans are becoming aware that what Snowden has done is an incredible public service, and as long as they can get around this notion that they have nothing to fear, if they have nothing to hide, well, that's what a lot of people in Germany thought before they were, we know what happened in the 30s in Germany, don't we?
Yes, sir. Ray, I always hate to stop, but we have run out of time. www.raymcgovern.com. Check out the links there. Ray, thank you very much for taking another hour with us on Tell Somebody.
You're most welcome, Tom. Good luck to you.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody. www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.